everybody. Hi, how are you doing today? It's a beautiful, beautiful, warm, sunny day here in New York City. And I'm very happy to be here today to talk about something really chewy and juicy. We're going to be talking about burgers today. And before I do, I just wanted to direct you to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. You may or may not be aware that tonight is the start of the Plant-Powered and Thriving Expert Series. There will be three of them, and it's brought to you by the Food Revolution Network. And I'm a part of that team with John and Ocean Robbins. Tonight, they'll be talking with Joel Fuhrman, my favorite medical doctor, and I'm sure there'll be lots of interesting and new information that you may not have heard about yet. And then Chris Wark is another part of the series in a couple of days. And then the last expert on this series is me, and I'll be talking about my favorite subject, food, and how much I love healthy, delicious, vegan, plant food, whole food. It's just a topic that I can't seem to shut up about, and I'll be talking a bit about that with John and Ocean Robbins on June 2nd. So I hope you get an opportunity to tune in. That's the Plant-Powered and Thriving Expert Series. And go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and you can get more information about that. Excellent. Carol Adams is with us. She's the author of numerous books, including The Sexual Politics of Meat, Neither Man Nor Beast, Feminism and the Defense of Animals, and The Pornography of Meat. She is the co-editor of several path-breaking anthologies, including Ecofeminism, Feminist Intersections with Other Animals and the Earth with Lori Gruen. Her work is the subject of two recent anthologies, Defiant Daughters, 21 Women of Art, Activism, Animals, and The Sexual Politics of Meat and The Art of Animal. 14 Women Artists Explore the Sexual Politics of Meat, in which a new generation of feminists, artists, and activists respond to Adams' groundbreaking work. Today, we're talking about one of her new books, Burger. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thanks for having me on, Karen.
You're welcome. I made sure to eat before we started talking about burgers.
It's so funny. When I was working on this book, I wanted to eat burgers every day. It was so, I've never had quite that experience writing a book. And of course, I've got books on veggie burgers and making your own veggie burgers. And there's so many choices. So I did not actually have to eat the same veggie burger every day, even when I craved it.
Well, some of the book makes burgers not sound very delicious, but there are other parts that just get my mouth watering, and we'll touch on all of that. What's fascinating to me about reading the book and thinking about the burger is that it is so symbolic of humanity and our culture, so many dimensions.
It's fascinating when you start to look at it, especially in terms of the myth-making of the United States, how the burger had to become central to who we are within the United States as citizens, and then becomes this representation that gets exported all around the world. So there's American burgers that you can, joints that you can go to in London or in Scotland, in Toronto, where something that is claimed to have been created here just gets reproduced over and over and over again.
We are living this myth of history, this myth of who we are, who we're supposed to be, what we expect ourselves to be, how people from outside of the United States are supposed to treat us. It's one big giant myth, and the hamburger sits on top of it.
It's very true. When I decided to write about the burger, I knew that I wanted the trajectory to be something that looked at the hamburger but did not assume the hamburger was the be-all and end-all of consumption. So I made a couple decisions. One was that I would define the burger as a single protein, single portion protein patty. And once I did that, I could look throughout history for other examples of single portion protein patties. And I found them in 2500 BCE, Southern India, the falafel, croquettes and veggie cutlets all would qualify. One of the things that does is it dismantles the idea that vegans are just trying to reproduce something that was a meat-based food. Because if we were eating these kind of textures and shapes before the hamburger was ostensibly created at the end of the 19th century, then it isn't that we're seeking to reproduce meat, but that we're actually reclaiming the patty to be what it originally was. Well, you know, I'm giving away part of the book. But the other thing I wanted to do was I read a lot of books on hamburgers. And the fascinating thing was every single one of them ignored where the hamburger came from, ignored the cow, ignored the history of colonialism that brought about the sweeping changes to the Midwest plains, the elimination of the buffalo, the moving of Native Americans from their native land into reservations. All of that paved the way for cows to be on that land. And then the advances at the end of the 19th century in terms of technology, refrigerated railroad cars, for instance, allowed dead cows to be dispersed from Chicago to other places. And all of this helped other technologies of violence, like the slaughterhouse itself and barbed wire, helped to create the environment in which hamburgers grew.
Well, you're the one who coined the phrase absent reverent.
Yes, and there I found it, for sure.
Here it is again.
Because the hamburger is so far distanced from the body of the cow, macerated, ground up. Now we know it could have pieces of cow from 1,000 different cows. And so it truly is a terrible and a great example of the absent referent in a tragic way. And what happened was that each of these hamburger historians completely reinforced this idea of the absent referent, ignoring how the cow becomes hamburger. So I wanted to put that back into the history too. So I have a chapter called Cow Burger that looks at that and the history of colonialism and the relationship between colonialism and the growth of the hamburger.
History is a fascinating thing, especially from the view of those who are telling it. I think about the book 1984, where we learn about it's a fictitious book, of course, but it talks about how history constantly changes based on those who are in control and how they want it perceived, and we still do that to this day. And I was surprised to see that even the Smithsonian couldn't get the history of the hamburger right.
Well, actually, what they get wrong is the history of the veggie burger. Because what they do, I mean, they might have also erred in other ways, but they trace the veggie burger only back to 1980. And I benefited from social media. I posted onto Facebook a few years ago and said, tell me examples of popular culture references to veggie burgers. And one person said, look at The 7 Year Itch, the movie from the Billy Wilder movie from the mid 1950s. And sure enough, the star is shown just after having finished consuming a soya burger. He's in a vegetarian restaurant. So you can't have veggie burgers be created in the 1980s if someone's eating a soya burger in a movie in 1956. But I thought what was interesting about that is that what it does is it just deprives us of the robust nature of the veggie burger in the 20th century. That really, from the moment the hamburger sort of makes it into the consciousness of the United States, which is at the end of the 1890s, it then suffers a setback with the publication in 1906 of The Jungle, then starts to come back. The first franchise really is White Castle, which is started in 1921. But all along, nipping at its heels, were veggie burgers, because people like John Harvey Kellogg were trying to create protein-rich meals for Seventh-day Adventists, 50% of whom follow a vegetarian diet. And so veggie burgers were being created, gluten patties, they were called, and you can find them in early 20th century cookbooks. by the 30s, you've got them advertised. You've got several companies that provide food to Seventh-day Adventists featuring a soya burger or another kind of sort of gluten burger. And then with World War II, there were meatless days and meat rationing. And the result was that companies like White Castle went looking for a veggie burger. And lo and behold, they found so many varieties. Even the New York Times celebrated soya burgers and bean burgers during World War II. There was a sense almost then that a soya burger was the food of the future. But we know that didn't happen back then.
Okay, I something just popped into my head just talking about White Castle, and I'm sure you don't know the answer to this, but I remember McDonald's tried a bunch of times to introduce veggie burgers. They tried like 10 years ago here in Manhattan, and it was disgusting. And the question is, why, with all of these options out there, why did they have to create something that wasn't palatable?
Well, I think what's more interesting is that the minute mad cow disease struck England, a London McDonald's in 1996 had a veggie burger.
And in India, they have them too.
Right. That's what I was going to say. So, I mean, maybe they'll go the way of White Castle. White Castle now has the Impossible Burger. I know Ethan Brown, when I met him, he's the founder of Beyond Meat and makes a mighty fine Beyond Burger. I know that his vision is for McDonald's to have Beyond Burgers, that this is all possible. How McDonald's can be this slow, not that we want to actually help support McDonald's, but the interesting thing I read for the book was that McDonald's provides 1% of the food for the whole world every day. But that doesn't mean it's burgers. When you look at how they adapt their food offerings, say in Russia with potatoes or cabbage, or in India, as you point out, with the veggie burgers, they're constantly adapting. I'd like to see them adapt right out of eating or serving cow burgers.
1% is way too much, but they are a company who are really a real estate company and not really a food company, and they have a lot of real estate all over the world. And if they could get with the program and help reduce the amount of animal suffering in the world, that would be a good thing. Let's talk about the word cow, because I was fascinated to find out that it was linked to the word money and capital.
So this is the interesting thing about etymologies, that cattle, this whole notion of what is capitalism, that capitalism is related to chattel and cattle. And so right from the beginning, I mean, there's an interesting etymology I talk about in the Sexual Politics of Meat that referred to cattle as the basis for one language's word for war. And, I mean, one of the things we know about cattle is that cows, and I try to use the word cow rather than cattle so that we don't end up with this sort of use of cattle reinforcing capital. This is how it's traced, that the cattle is derived from the Middle English and Old Northern French cattel, and then the late Latin for capital. And so it's like chattel or chief property. So I was trying in the book to use cow rather than livestock or cattle. I mean, livestock itself reminds us of this capitalism aspect. But the fact about the cow is the cow needs space. The cow, Jeremy Rifkin calls the cow a hooved locust, that when cows aren't native to the United States or to North America, what we now know of as North America, cows are a product of colonialism in that they are brought to this land. And one of the things they did is they forced Native Americans to change how they farmed. because Native Americans in New England, the New England colonies, did not have fences. But they needed to put up fences to keep the cows from trampling their plants. So enclosures and the loss of common space all accompanied bringing cows over. Even by the 1850s, there is an environmentalist writing about how many cattle or cows take up land in the United States and how this is keeping the land from providing more food for people. 120 years before Diet for a Small Planet.
I'm fascinated about words, and not only words, but names. And I just want to throw this out because I think it's a bit Dickensian that two entrepreneurs that are promoting these new kinds of burgers, plant burgers, Ethan Brown and Pat Brown, their last names are both Brown. Burgers are brown. I'm thinking about, well, when I think about Bernie Madoff, who made off with everything, and when I think of the guy who's playing president right now and he's trumping everybody, I'm just always like connecting the dots between it's interesting who take the lead positions and their names.
Well, I think what's more interesting about Brown, and we should just say that Ethan and Pat are not related, is that they each have a burger that changes color.
Brown.
Yeah. So the veggie burgers we make, when we put them, you know, we make a great black bean burger, or you make a kidney bean burger, or you make a portobello burger, those burgers aren't really going to change colors when we cook them. But when you cook a Beyond Burger or have an Impossible Burger, I watched one being prepared when I visited the headquarters of Impossible Foods and met Pat Brown. When you watch these burgers being cooked, they change color. So I think that that's one of the innovations they're going for. When I've talked about this book, Burger, with audiences, whether it's in Toronto or Buffalo or wherever, there are some vegans who say, yes, but I don't want that taste. I don't want that texture. And my response is to remind them that what both Ethan and Pat Brown have said is they're not making these burgers for vegans. Yes, if vegans like that and have missed that kind of taste, fine, but they're really making it for meat eaters, flesh eaters. And so what I often say is that they're making it for people who are so craven that even though they know they shouldn't be eating dead cows at this point for environmental health and ethical reasons, they haven't figured out how to take that next step. So they're truly trying to reach the market that McDonald's is reaching or that high-end hamburger places are reaching, not our market, the market that we're known, you know, vegans are known for.
Yeah, I definitely can relate to that. I've tried these burgers. They do nothing for me, but I realize what they're doing, and anything, like I said before, that's going to reduce animal cruelty and suffering, you know, I'm all behind that. But humanity, we're really kind of a crazy species.
Well, I wouldn't say crazy.
Okay.
I think that we're
easily manipulated.
Well, I think one of the things that happened throughout the 20th century, I mean, the 20th century is categorized as a century in which production got displaced by consumption, so that the act of consumption is part of our identity. And that part of that, even though consumption does involve making decisions, it's a little more passive than production. And I think the evolution of the 20th century was towards more passivity. Oh, what does it matter what I do? So there's that's one way of passivity. I'm not going to cause any change. So what does it matter what I do? The second way of passivity is being on the receiving end of culture rather than being culture makers, TV watching, movie watching, et cetera. And so that passivity may create this inability to realize that each of us and our decisions about consumption actually matter. They're not the only thing that matters. I mean, if the United States stopped supporting animal agriculture, the hamburger would probably be $35. It would automatically not be competitive if the producers of hamburgers had to pay for the water pollution, the water use, had to actually clean up the water that they're polluting, had to not have the use of fossil fuels or have that be taxed more. They'd have a much more expensive product.
You're very diplomatic and nice to our fellow human beings.
I think that what happens, I talk about this in Living Among Meat Eaters, that people who aren't vegan think change is hard, but they're working harder not to change. They're working harder believing that what they've got is all they can achieve. They're just this side of the kind of liberation that teaches us that we're constantly changing. Becoming vegan isn't enough. Of course, we need to be very socially engaged around injustice at this time. So anyone who thinks that any of our goals is simply we'll become vegan and then you don't have to worry about anything. No, we need to be constantly attuned to the kind of social injustice that has helped to create a world in which hamburgers are cheap.
And like I said, it's not just hamburgers. I think of so many recipes that I'm always creating and recreating. And when I look into how they started or how they originated, so many of them change as people migrate and move around and different ingredients aren't available. So they change them. I mean, everything changes, even our food recipes.
Right. And that's part of the joy. But people also like comfort food. They want to know that something isn't changing. They want spaghetti like their grandmother made or you know, whatever. I mean, maybe Generation X isn't, it can't be described in that way. And I hope that they're breaking through on some of these areas. But for those who think they can't change, the Beyond Burger, the Impossible Burger, there's Hungry Planet. I want to mention Hungry Planet, which is based in the Midwest, and they have a great burger as well that's getting into cafeterias and high schools. I'm happy that we've got visionaries who are trying to respond at a different level while we activists are also responding at a grassroots level. Mm-hmm. I think we need all levels for change. I think one of the things about the burger is I was trying to, just as in the sexual politics of meat, help educate people who eat, who, I mean, first of all, anybody who reads is automatically also a person who eats since we all eat, but to educate readers about the hidden aspects of who they're eating. And so one of the chapters that I put in is about the modernist identity crises of the hamburger. How many different issues have arisen for the hamburger, from environmental to E. coli to mad cow, the McLibel trial in England, the Oprah trial here in Texas, all of the ways that eating a hamburger has been problematized. So I talk about the hamburger as having been a modernist solution to protein delivery that's now outmoded, that now has to be superseded, undone. It's an untenable solution, but a modernist solution. And just like modernist designs for public housing are seen as problematic. So the modernist response to protein delivery is problematic. And we've got the answers. Plant protein.
Single portion protein patties.
Right.
Okay, we just have a few minutes left. Can we talk a minute about libraries?
Sure.
Now, I love libraries in so many ways, and you dedicated your book to the memory of Forrest Gerard Nearing, the son of your colleague and friend, research librarian Jane Gerard Nearing. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. And all the work that she's done for you. Libraries are struggling just like so many other things because they require public funding. And tell me about your feelings about libraries.
I love libraries. I've been a library goer since I was in elementary school, and that library was 5 miles from our house. We did not have a library except the school library in the small village I grew up in. I've studied at the British Library, at the New York Public Library. I'd love to study at the Library of Congress. I've been there. The University of Rochester and Yale and Harvard libraries. I love the opportunity that we are given to learn about a variety of subjects just by walking through stacks. Mm-hmm. But in the case of Jane and her work on this book, for instance, I was trying to find the first references to soya burgers. And there she finds an ad for, and I refer to it in the veggie burger chapter, for a Thanksgiving dinner in a Midwest city that says, we've got everything you need, and it lists veggie burgers as one of them. And it's the mid-70s, the late 70s. And it just shows you that culture was changing so quickly. And she just digs in. She's a great example of how librarians want to help us be the best readers and thinkers we can be. And I'm so glad that you've raised the thing about who I dedicated the book to, because here's someone I never met, but I really felt that his mom and I were weaving together a memory of him through the research on this book. Mm-hmm. And I needed to mark that in mm-hmm. the dedication.
Okay, one last question. You taste a lot of plant burgers. Is there a favorite for you?
I love trying new burgers, and I have tried new burgers all this year, all over the country and in Toronto. It's sort of amazing. I like a black bean burger that we provide the recipe for in Never Too Late to Go Vegan. Mm-hmm. Once in a while, I like to have a portobello burger, which is just the portobello on bread. But my go-to that I'm using to introduce other people to it and that I have found is lots of fun to prepare with a variety of different accoutrements rather than condiments is the Beyond Burger. Mm-hmm. It's fun. And for those who haven't tried it, when I had it at the Beyond Meat headquarters, they cooked it medium heat with the skillet already warmed up. 3 minutes aside, and voila.
All right. Well, it's becoming easier and easier to get the Beyond Burger in many, many places. I see it all over the place, at least here in New York, and I'm often in California. And
I'd encourage people to try an Impossible Burger if they go out, or find out about more about Hungry Planet, because expanding the repertoire of our burgers, plant-based burgers is a great thing. We've got a great opportunity to help people change. And what better food to help them change with than the very ordinary U.S. loved, beloved, iconic burger.
That says it all. Thank you, Carol Adams, for joining me on It's All About Food for this very meaty discussion about your book, Burger.
Thank you. Plant-based meat.
Yes. Woo! Thank you. I look forward to everything else you're writing.
Thanks very much.
Okay. Bye-bye. That was Carol Adams, author of Burger, and I recommend it. I recommend it for many reasons. It's a great resource and tool if you need to have discussion points about the benefits of eating plant-based, and there's a lot of good history in there that can load you up on your facts. Very good. And we're going to continue talking about burgers in a moment. I just wanted to share with you a few little things about my recent trip in Quebec. I was in Quebec last week. It was absolutely phenomenal. And you can read more about the foods that I discovered and the great eating at my blog at responsibleeatingandliving.com. The blog is called What Vegans Eat. But just briefly, I wanted to talk about a few things. People often ask what to bring on an airplane when you want to bring food. And it's difficult because we have this challenge about liquids and paste and things we can't bring with us on board. Actually, I'm going to save this little part for my next guest because he knows all about food for flying. So I'm going to save that tidbit. I'm just going to move on and say I discovered some wonderful crepes. And one of the things, I knew this when I lived in France in the 90s, and somehow I forgot about it. But many traditional French-style crepes that are made with buckwheat flour, sarrasin, are vegan. They are egg-free and dairy-free. Of course, whenever you go into a restaurant, you want to check because you never know what kind of secret ingredients they might want to slip in. But traditionally, they are vegan. And we discovered this one place that made wonderful crepes. I went back a couple of times just before they were so good. And then I went home and I started making my own crepes. So please visit my blog, What Vegans Eat, and read all about my adventure in Quebec. Now I want to bring on my next guest, Marty Crutolo. And for more than three decades, he was a commercial and charter pilot and recently founded Marty's V Burger in Manhattan, which boasts a unique vegan patty made with seitan, rice, and beans. Marty, are you here?
Karen, I'm right here. How are you today?
Good. How's your refrigerator?
Oh, he hasn't shown up yet, so it could be any minute. I have a broken refrigerator. I'm waiting for a repairman in our office.
Right. But I never wish that on anyone anywhere.
I feel honored to follow Carol. She's just so knowledgeable about the whole food industry, and I'm just a pilot who now sort of flips burgers for a living.
Well, one of the very important things in order to make change, and we were just talking about making change, is having access to the materials that make change possible. And access means places where we can go to get the food that we want to eat, and that means restaurants that serve vegan burgers.
Well, it's interesting. You were talking about the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger, and we have both of them on our menu. And when we started, when we introduced them, we did a poll on Facebook and Instagram. And the poll was, I think, 49-51% for one versus the other, and another poll was 50-50. So when you say that some of them replicate the taste and aroma of meat, I find that, as far as vegans go anyway, there's two schools. And I'm of the school where the closer somebody can come to replicating something that I don't eat anymore, the better. If somebody could replicate my grandmother's meatloaf, I'd be so happy. And then the other school is anything that reminds them or comes close to reminding them of what the animal component of the meal was, want nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're also seeing in the restaurant is very interesting is that people will come in based on trying this new food. And I don't want to say it's a fad kind of thing, but anything that gets somebody who's not vegan into my restaurant to try something new, I just think it's a win. It's a win for
Absolutely.
Everybody.
Yep. Bring in the curious. And sure. Like I've said many times, it takes courage. It takes courage to change. It takes courage to try new foods. And it's a great thing.
Now, I must say, I am a little disappointed. Might not be the right word, but maybe disappointed when people come in and they order the Impossible or the Beyond and not my burger. But then again, we didn't put that burger on the poll because we wanted the poll to be fair, and we didn't want to put our ringer in there for it.
Ah, very good. Let's back up a little bit and talk about when you were flying Marty.
Yes. What would you like to know about that life?
Yeah. I talked to, I don't know, years ago on my other show when I had the show Ask a Vegan, I think it was, and we talked a bit about your life as a flying vegan.
Yeah, started out as a vegetarian and then went to vegan. And I, of course, don't have any airline credentials these days, so I'm in the same boat of what do I bring on the airplane as everybody else is. And I will say that since I stopped flying about three and a half years ago, the quantity and the quality of vegan options in the airport terminals is astounding. I'm a go-to guy for sandwiches and fruit. Nobody has ever said anything about that. Hummus was taken away from us once.
Because it's a paste.
Yeah, it's obviously explosive.
If it's spread on a sandwich, it seems to be okay, but if it's in a container, it's not.
Well, let's not try to reason the rules at the checkpoints, because I'm not sure there is any reason behind some of them. But I think that if things are wrapped when you buy them in a store and there's some kind of a label on it and it's wrapped, there's less eyebrows raised. Of course, the rule with liquids applies and the paste applies. But, you know, I mean, where are we going that we can't survive for a couple of hours with just eating a banana?
Yeah, that's true. You can always bring fruit, and I always do. And if you're going into a foreign country, they're not going to want you to enter into their country with the fruit. But you eat it before you get there, and that's fine.
Sure. To eat it, or there's plenty of facilities at customs to throw things out.
Sure. I don't like wasting, though. I'd rather eat it. I'm one of those. I got that kind of crazy mentality. No waste. I wanted to talk about when I was just leaving for Quebec, which was last week. I was so excited about bringing food on the plane with me because I was traveling with Deo Robbins, John Robbins' wife. Uh-huh. And she was coming from California, staying overnight, and then we were flying from New York, and she was concerned about having food for her trip to Canada. So I wanted to make some special things because I love her. And I just recently posted this new recipe where I used, it's like a breaded baked tofu, and the breading is made from pumpkin seeds grounded up and spices, and it's just amazing. And so I thought I would make that, bake it the day before, and travel with it. And I'm not concerned too much about baked tofu being refrigerated for a few hours. I bring it with me in a cold, one of these bags that keeps things cold, and it's fine. And then I was going to make sweet potato toast, where you slice it like in thin slices and bake them all and bring them along. And I prepped everything. It was beautiful. Turned on my oven, and my oven wasn't working.
Oh, no.
Now, the oven's 18 years old. It's had a good run. And the happy ending is it's working again. But at that point in time, it wasn't. And we had to bring a service guy in to fix it. So I had to kind of get creative. And I ended up, the sweet potatoes were okay. I put them on a stovetop grill and cooked them that way. They were fine. But the tofu with the breading was very fragile. And they turned out edible, but they weren't beautiful.
The best laid plans sometimes just turn into a mash.
Mm-hmm. But you got to be careful if you're bringing it on a plane, because a mash may be confused as a paste or something too liquidy. It had to look firm. Anyway, let's get back to veggie burgers.
Sure.
So when did you open your veggie burger?
Our restaurant opened last July, so we're just about coming up on a year.
Wow. And what have you learned in that year? Because running restaurants is never easy.
What I learned was I should have written it all down, because it'd be a bestseller book by now. The trials and tribulations of dealing with real estate and construction in Manhattan is something that if you haven't done, it's incomprehensible what you have to go through and how many hoops there are that you have to jump through. Every time we turned around in the space, there was some other issue that had to be dealt with. So whether it was demolishing the walls and finding that there wasn't the right fireproofing and we had to do it, and we had to shore up the joists in the basement, and the plumbing system had to be redone, and the electrical system, and dealing with Con Ed. So nothing to do with food yet, just 18 months to get the doors open. So dealing with food is so much fun and so much heartache at the same time. I don't even know if I can describe the feeling of watching somebody eat my food and then write online that it's the best veggie burger they've ever had in their life. Or tell me face to face. And you know what? When we talk about burgers, it's an interesting kind of thing, because when I ate meat, if we had burgers, it was all about the seasonings and it was all about the flavors. And Chef Kevin Archer told me this once when he did at the Jivamukti Cafe, he did a class about Thanksgiving, and he said it doesn't really matter what proteins we use and what stuffing flavors we use. It's all about the seasonings that we recall as the memory. So when we take a burger and we put a special sauce on and a cheese and pickles and lettuce, and we recreate a childhood favorite that I used to eat all the time from one of the big fast food chains, I'm trying to hit that flavor profile exactly. And whether I do it with an Impossible Burger or a Beyond Burger or my burger, we're still trying to hit those trigger points of pleasure in the brain and recall those pleasurable moments. So I think that when we talk about burgers, the flavorings and the seasonings have to be brought into the picture as well.
Mm-hmm. For me, it's all the accoutrements, as Carol called it, the condiments. And I like a good sauce, sautéed onions, sautéed mushrooms, of course, tomato and ketchup, and a good bun. And what else could I put on there? I'm not into pickles myself, but maybe one little pickle.
Well, we have our own special sauce. We also have a steak sauce, and every sauce that we sell in the restaurant, you can get on any item that we have in the restaurant. So if you want barbecue sauce on your burger, we will make you happy.
Have it your way at Marty's V-Burger.
Yeah, that's it. And we're also located in an interesting area. We're on 27th and Lexington, and it is an area that is known as Murray Hill, but referred to as Curry Hill because of all of the restaurants in that area.
Yes.
And so we thought that it might be interesting to see if vegetarians who came to that area looking for vegetarian food would eat at our restaurant, or were they going to eat the food from their native countries and they happen to be vegetarian at the same time. And we're seeing a little bit of a crossover. It's nothing remarkable, but we do see people who are vegetarians who have never eaten chicken or never eaten a burger come into our restaurant and become repeat customers.
Smart move.
Yeah, I think it's all about getting someone to try the first bite. I'm very fond of saying we don't eat tree bark and leaves anymore. And it's true, because and this is an issue where vegan companies and advertising, should we use the word vegan when we say we're a restaurant, we're a vegan restaurant, or are we 100% vegetarian restaurant? Or do we not say anything and just say Marty's V-Burger and you figure it out? And we have had people come in, look at the menu, you can see the light bulb going off, and they're, oh, this is vegan. Oh, okay, thank you. And then they leave, and it's just such a missed opportunity when we can't get them. And I say, listen, buy the burger. If you don't like it, I'll give you money back. Because I know that people will love the burger.
Right. Yep. They just have to have the courage.
Yeah, the first bite. And then also people will come in for the Impossible Burger, and they'll be looking around. They'll be like, those drumsticks look pretty good. Oh, you have a Krabby Patty? And then they'll try something else, and they'll try something else. And now we've broadened their experience, and we've expanded their mind. And the next time somebody says, oh, that vegan food? They'll be like, oh, no. Let me tell you about a place I go to. And that's how we have to spread the message. That's our activism, is on the food side. We have to make a profit. It is a capitalist system that we work under, and we do have to get the rent paid every month. But really, it's about vegans, I say, will find us. But yep. It's the omnivores that stumble in or come for another reason or are coming with their friend. I'm not hungry. I'm not going to have anything to eat, but I just, and then all of a sudden they're ordering some food. Whether it's the fries, the chili fries, the cheese fries, the chili cheese fries, the flavor profiles pop.
I just want to congratulate you, Marty, because you're one of the few who have had a dream and put that dream into action. And you had a lot of challenges this year. You described a few of them with the building and getting the space in place and jumping through all the regulation hoops that there were to jump through. A lot of people talk about, oh, I want to open a restaurant. And it's very hard work, and it's very hard to make it happen. So I'm proud to know you.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. It's an amazing experience. And I'm not sure, actually I am sure, that other people who have gone into this industry, who are in this industry, who open a single restaurant, another one, and another one, have gone through very similar things. In New York City, it's a little bit like the Wild West in terms of what you'll find and what people have managed to perhaps get away with in the past. And the way the law is written, if you don't know about it, you can't fix it. But if you know about it, now you sort of have to fix it and bring it up to code. So these experiences with other people in the restaurant business are—it's a shared, the dream at sometimes becomes a nightmare, but then you wake up from it.
Yes, unfortunately, I'm sure it's true in many places, but in New York City, we've seen a lot of turnover, and the local government benefits from that because you're spending all of these fees for permits and things just to make it happen even before it happens. And then if it doesn't work, then somebody else comes in and tries to do it, and they spend more money on their fees to make it happen.
Sure. I know that the fees are a revenue stream for the city, but I also think that when a restaurant makes it and starts to get traction and the sales increase and then the sales tax increase, that there's a benefit to the success of a restaurant as well. I'm looking forward to opening up another one and another one and another one until I hit 5,000. But that's a number I have up on the wall. I don't know whether I'll, I'm 62 years old, and I want to get out of this business by the time I'm 90.
Good. You're just getting started. I like it.
Yeah. Perfect age for a second career, right?
Absolutely. I am in sync with you. I just turned 60. And I've got a gazillion projects that are on my list to do. And I finally feel like I'm in the right mindset and feeling energetic and strong and fueled by plants. I can do anything.
I feel the same way. And part of our mission statement is to put out good food at the lowest possible price to feed the most amount of people, to do the most amount of good, and save the most amount of animals. So that notwithstanding, we have a philosophy of donating and making contributions to various vegan organizations and some sanctuaries, and whether it's a gift card for a raffle or it's food that we have left over after we do an event that we donate for homeless meals, that's also part of the game. As a pilot, it's sort of interesting. I flew airlines and I flew charter, and I flew some very, very wealthy people. I mean, like 1% of the 1% wealthy. And I never understood how somebody could be worth $1 billion. I just, to me, I was like, I couldn't give it away fast enough. You know, so I hope everybody in the audience is rooting for me to be the billionaire so that I could give it all away to Sanctuary.
So, Marty, I'm rooting for you. What I love about most vegan restaurants that I am familiar with, and I can't say that I know all of them, but the ones that I go to and I'm in love with, I find for the most part vegan proprietors of restaurants have a passion like you do and a mission like you do and are extremely generous and extremely caring about their food. And then I want to go a little further and say we don't always find that in mainstream restaurants. And I read your recent post on Facebook where you went to a place that offered vegan options and stuck in some non-vegan cheese by accident.
What I've said all along is I see vegans who get excited when White Castle brings on the Impossible Burger, and Carol mentioned that Ethan Brown wanted McDonald's to carry the Beyond Burger, and I think that's all great. And then vegans go, and they're served something with butter, or it's a non-vegan bun, and then the complaints start. And
yeah.
I think that we need to recognize where we are putting ourselves and what our expectations have to be. And the first time I had the Impossible Burger, I sat down with my wife. We said, oh, we're vegan, we're eating vegan food, we want vegan food, we want the vegan burger, we want the vegan bun and the vegan cheese and the vegan lettuce and the vegan tomato and the vegan fries and the vegan, you know, napkin and the vegan fork. And as I tell the story, I think I said it 27 times, but I should have said it 28 times, because as I finished the burger and started on the fries, and I finished the ketchup, and I dipped into what I thought was going to be mustard, and I put a big gob of mayonnaise in my mouth. And exactly. And look, I mean, I spent most of my life eating these foods, and I'm more repulsed by the idea than I am by the actual food, although it's probably close. But who's to blame here? I went to a restaurant that I knew served certain things that I find objectionable and ethically don't want anything to do with. I went there to try some food that I was thinking about bringing on board. So who could I blame? Well, of course I could blame the restaurant, and there is some culpability there, but who am I complaining to? I went where there was fire and I got burned. So
it's always a leap of faith when you eat in a restaurant, even though there are codes and regulations, it's a leap of faith.
When you go to a vegan restaurant, there in theory is some ethics behind the food. I care that there's no non-vegan items in my restaurant. When somebody comes in with a chicken cheese pizza, I do not allow them to eat it there.
Thank you.
No outside food. And
right.
That's how I can say no outside food. Do I really care if somebody goes to brings in a vegan dish from another place? Yeah, I don't really think it's cool, but I'm not going to stop you from eating it. Now we're moving towards a kosher certification, so that may come to an end. But you know, I care that you come to my place to eat vegan food, and you get exactly. It's not just about the money. Now, if I had a regular restaurant, I just want to turn tables. That's all I care about. When I'm in the restaurant, I always ask people how they like the food, because if you didn't have a good experience, I don't want your money. I want you as a customer. So
I love it. Marty, you're awesome. I'm so glad to have had this time to talk with you. I love your mission and everything you're doing. I'm reaching out and giving you a big hug, and I want you to succeed. I want you to have 50 billion Marty V burgers all over the world. And I want to thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you for having me. I really enjoy spending the time together.
Me too. I'll see you at the next event.
Sounds good.
Okay, take care. Marty Crudelo of Marty's V Burger. Visit Marty V Burgers in Manhattan when you have the next opportunity. Just like a minute left, and I wanted to remind you one more time that tonight is the beginning of the Food Revolution Network's Plant Powered and Thriving Expert Series. It's free. You'll hear Dr. Joel Fuhrman tonight. It's at 8:30 Eastern Time, 5:30 Pacific Time. And then the next expert speaking in a couple of days will be Chris Wark. And then on June 2nd, you've got me talking with my friends and colleagues, John Robbins and Ocean Robbins. So if you want to know more about it, this free event, go to responsibleeatingandliving.com. That's my website. That's where I live. You can click on the big banner on the right that talks about the Plant-Powered and Thriving Expert Series. You're going to enjoy it and learn a lot. I'm going to be listening tonight and in a couple of days, too. I know I'm going to get a lot out of it. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Have a delicious burger, vegan burger. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.